This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're going to do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we discuss public housing tenants fighting for respect and their rights in Washington, D.C. We also analyze the recently failed U.S.-backed coup attempt in Venezuela. But first, we have on Jeff Bigelow, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation out in Los Angeles, who has been a labor activist and worker for over 45 years. He discusses the ongoing oils worker strike that has been going on since the beginning of this month. So what events led to the oil worker strike initiated on February 1st?
But as you pointed out, the strike began on February 1st, and it began in nine different refineries across the country. And the strike didn't happen just because something happened the day before. This strike has been building for years, and particularly over the last several years, when the union has been making demands on the companies for basic rights on health and safety, and yet the companies who are flush with profits obviously, by their actions, don't really care about the safety of the workers, have refused to deal with these issues. The issues have to do with not having enough staff on the job, so that there is fatigue by the workers who are working in the most dangerous conditions. And when I say fatigue, you know, everybody gets tired on the job, but in this case, these workers are working like 12 and 15-hour shifts for 12 days in a row, for example. And those shifts themselves change, so that you might be working day shift today, and 2 days from now you might be working an evening shift, and another day from that you might be working another shift. And frankly, having done that myself, I know it can be completely exhausting. And as you know, that the workers are working in with highly explosive situations. So it's a danger to the workers themselves. It's a danger to the community. And so these demands have been both worker-based and community-based. In addition to that, the companies have been using more and more contractual employees to perform the work, just as is the case in many other industries, where they try to get workers who don't have union rights, who don't have the same level of benefits in terms of insurance and vacation, pension, et cetera, and they can exploit those workers to a greater degree. And that's another issue that is existing in the refineries right now, that they're trying to stop the use of these contractual employees. And while it's not a main issue in the strike, certainly wages would have to be a concern by anybody who's working, anybody particularly who's working for these fabulously wealthy oil companies who are in turn controlled by finance capital, who don't want to get up off of any money for the workers themselves. So those are the issues that are driving it. And the fact that the companies have been refusing to do even the simplest things along those lines, that's what's triggered this strike.
Mm. And we're talking about over like 6 or 7,000 workers already involved in this strike, right? So what's the significance of the strike, especially during this period?
Right. Well, there are about 6,500 workers on strike right now, affecting about 25% of the refinery capacity in the United States. The union has the ability to shut down about two-thirds of the refining capacity, so they've been ramping up this struggle since the strike began on February 1st. The significance of this is that it's a battle against the biggest forces of big oil, and big oil is integrated in with finance capital. It's integrated with the military-industrial complex. This is a fight against the titans of industry and the titans of the war-making machine, the titans of those people who are trying to control the government. And so this is really a battle for everybody. Who isn't affected by the issue of health and safety? Who isn't affected by the issue of contractual employees or others, or an employer trying to use cheaper labor to undermine existing labor? So these issues affect everybody. Certainly, everybody lives within a 20 mile radius of a refinery. They have a definite, huge, direct, personal interest in this. And that's a very big percentage of the U.S. population. And more recently, you know, the I don't know if you drive because you're a big city, but more recently, in the last couple of days, the big business media has been hyping up the rising cost of gasoline, which is out here in California, has risen dramatically over the last month. And now they're trying to tie this to the refinery worker strike, which is there's no logical tie there. So they're trying to turn the public against the refinery workers.
And you've kind of alluded to it already, but in an article you recently wrote for Liberation News, you stated that, quote, everyone has an interest in showing solidarity with oil workers. Can you go more into it?
Yes, and that's particularly important right now. I mean, as the strike is extended into its third week right now, and more refineries are participating in the strike, it's incumbent upon everybody in the community to come to their aid, to participate on the picket line, to pass resolutions in their own neighborhood community associations or in their own local unions, because if management can defeat this strike, then it means that there's less safety for every community. If management can defeat this strike, it means that there's less of an ability for everybody to try to get a simple raise, to try to get some simple rights on the job. So it's really in everybody's interest to be for this, because a victory for the oil workers, or victory for these refinery workers, will be a victory for everybody.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Jeff. We're going to keep up to date with this and hopefully get you back on soon to keep track of the progress on this.
Thank you very much.
This is Eugene Perrier with Skylove Point Dexter Moore, who heads up the public housing campaign at Empower DC. Skylove, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Good. So before we get into some of the work you're doing here in DC, I wanted to speak a little more generally, because one of the things we hear a lot with public housing is that the problem is essentially the residents. It's all these poor people living in one place together, and it's creating all these problems, and we have to break them up. So how do you respond to that kind of rhetoric?
Well, first of all, that really offends me because I am one of those people that they speak of. And when someone tells me that it's not a good thing for me to live around people like myself, it makes me wonder, well, what's wrong with myself? What are you saying is wrong with me for me to live around people that are just like me? So I take very high offense to that. I don't live in poverty. I don't have a lot of money because my neighbor, I didn't catch it as a disease. It didn't happen because, you know, I lived around somebody. It happened because of this system that has been set up to engineer poverty. So when people say that to me, or when I hear that, it really offends me, and I push back against it.
And so it, almost in a phrase, I guess, it's that the problem isn't so much the concentrated poverty, it's that this system does nothing to lift people out of
poverty. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the concentration of poverty, in a sense, even the term, is that, you know, society and the government has to visually see what they've done, and now they've come up with a word to detract from what they've created, to say that it's just happened, or, you know, this kind of quote unquote concentrated poverty is just a coincidence. No, it happened because of the way that it was set up. But people living in this have made the best of our situations. We've come together, we've built communities, we rely on each other, strong social networks. And, you know, to say the word concentrated poverty is really just a visual reminder of how many people actually live in poverty. To deconcentrate poverty the way this government wants to do it is to hide it, to mask it, to mix us up with other people so they don't have to see it. But I think that, you know, to actually see poverty, to visually see it, is, you know, you have to deal with it.
And you guys do a lot of work around a range of issues at Empower DC. So it, just a few things, obviously doesn't have to be comprehensive. What are the things that really could address, other than attacking public housing, what could really address the needs of the folks who are in poverty?
jobs. You know, I've heard the saying, nothing stops a bullet like a job. You know, so definitely jobs number one. I think that, you know, I see so many people with so much potential in the areas that I work in and that I live in. There's so much potential. People just need to be met where they are. And jobs is the number one thing. When you go door to door and talk to people, they want jobs, sustainable jobs, jobs that pay a living wage. A second thing would be meaningful wraparound services. We need addiction counselors. We need psychologists. We need psychiatrists. We need all types of services that will really help a person holistically. Several types. One program is not going to help a mass of people. We need several types of programs that get to the root of the problem with poverty. And yeah, that starts with, I think the first thing would be jobs.
Well, I think certainly the listeners of this show will absolutely agree with that. And so to speak more directly about what you guys are doing here in D.C., now there really is an attack in public housing, on public housing here in the district. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
So Washington, D.C. is aggressively decimating their public housing stock. We've already lost thousands of units here in Washington, D.C. It is a national trend. The Housing and Urban Development, HUD, has, you know, publicly said that they're trying to steer away from public housing, that they that their public housing has been a failure. And the way that they deal with that failure, I guess, is to eradicate it and to get rid of it. However, this has a big effect on the people that live in these communities. So in Washington, D.C., we've had about 8 or 9 public housing properties that have been demolished. Communities have been broken up. Social ties have been dismantled. And we've had a lot of negative consequences that have happened from public housing properties being demolished.
And you guys here at Empower DC have a public housing campaign, and I certainly have been privileged to take part in some of the things that you have done. But can you say a little bit about what you are advocating for?
We are advocating for, one, a moratorium on the demolition of public housing. There needs to be an immediate stop to the demolition. Washington, D.C. is experiencing a very terrible homelessness crisis right now. One of the worst homeless crises we've ever had. And there's a direct link to the demolition of public housing. It's less units that people can afford to live in. The more you tear down, we see that the higher that homeless numbers have risen. So what we're fighting for is, one, a moratorium on the demolition, to fully locally fund repairs of public housing. People are living in slum conditions, and this is due to the neglect of the landlord, which is the government. The landlord has neglected public housing, so we're asking for local funding to repair current public housing. And then we're asking for meaningful services to uplift public housing. Allow residents to own small businesses within the public housing communities. Allow residents to take ownership and control over their properties, and allow for ongoing support for these residents. So we're looking to uplift and revitalize public housing for public housing people, not for other people. The message I would like to get out is that, you know, the poor, especially here in Washington, D.C., where I live, the poor are not invisible. We do not need to be eradicated. We should not be swept under the rug. We should not be dispersed. We should not be hidden. The low income, the working class, we're people. We're here. We're always going to be here. And the city really needs to understand that we should not be pushed out. We should be part of the social fabric of Washington, D.C., just like any other category of people. We need to be empowered. We need to be offered resources and given resources that we deserve, that we have a right to. The poor deserve just as much as anybody living in an affluent neighborhood. We're not asking for granite tops. We're not asking for pools in our backyard. We're asking for a chance to be self-sufficient, but also to continue to stay in our neighborhood and to be in units that are affordable. We're here. We're not going anywhere. And the city needs to understand that and cater to us just like they cater to the rich.
And for those who are listening around the country or in the D.C. area who may be looking to find ways to support you guys, how can they get in touch with you?
You can call us at 202-234-9119, or you can email me at housing@empowerdc.org.
And once again, this was Eugene Puryear with Liberation Radio, here with our guest, Skyla Poindexter Moore from Empower DC. Sky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Finally, we got a chance to speak with Gloria LaRiva, a national leader of the PSO, about the failed coup attempt that happened earlier this month against President Nicolas Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. So, Gloria, can you explain to our listeners what are some of the details behind this recent failed coup and what were some of the goals?
On February 12th of this year, President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela announced that a military coup plot of 10 generals and right-wing individuals had been thwarted, had been defeated, and yet the danger still remains against the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. The plan of the coup was the bombing of a number of sites in the capital of Caracas, including bombing the presidential palace, to assassinate President Maduro, to bomb the National Assembly, the Telesur TV network, which is continent-wide, the defense ministry, and public ministries in the city in order to set off a overthrow of the government. It included three prominent right-wing individuals who were really fascist, who had signed and prepared what was called a transition agreement, in which they were calling for a new government to be installed, for free market policies. It would have been a fascist coup, as they attempted in 2002 against President Hugo Chavez. And luckily it was thwarted. However, the hand of the United States is definitely involved in this latest plot, as it has been ever since Hugo Chavez was elected as president and became president in 1999. The U.S. is denying its role, but the government of Venezuela had announced, and part of their evidence was that the very speech, which was videotaped, an 8-minute videotape of one of the coup plotters, a retired general, was actually written by advisors in the U.S. Embassy of Caracas.
And really, the coup attempt is something that has been culminating for a few months, if not a year, I mean, really more, all the way back to 1999. But in the past year, especially, we've seen these kind of this economic war being waged in Venezuela and these destabilizing tactics. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, what that strategy is? It's nothing new in Latin America, obviously, but what does it mean right now for Venezuela?
In 2014, February 12th, was the beginning of very violent attacks in the city, in different cities of Venezuela, which were called guarimbas. It's a word used in Venezuela meaning violent attacks. And these guarimbas were instigated by the right wing. 43 people died in the violence. Some of the violence was really horrific, including the stringing of wire across roads so that people on motorcycles would actually be decapitated. That happened a number of times. Bombings, the firebombing of public buildings in different parts of the country. And it was instigated because last February in 2014, the government of President Maduro had announced that they would crack down on speculative practices by corporations which were hoarding food, deliberately trying to cause chaos and shortages in stores so that people would then go to the stores and try to empty them to make sure that they didn't run out of food and other essentials. This is part of an economic war being carried out by the right-wing opposition trying to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution, whose goal is socialism. And so that was last February 12th. That's why this year, on February 12th, the right-wing was attempting this military coup and bombing of a number of sites in Caracas. They, right now, in these last days following the February coup that was foiled, there have been more violence, especially in the western part of the country, in the state of Táchira, in the town of San Cristobal. And what I think that the right wing wants to do right now is to create violent incidents where they engage and force the engagement of police and the National Guard to try to then portray to the world and to the U.S. media and U.S. government that there is repression by the Venezuelan government. It's a very serious time right now, one of great risk, And it's why we need to have the greatest call for solidarity in the U.S. and around the world.
And can you continue on with some of the why is this so significant? Why are the risks so serious at this stage?
The coup that took place in April 2002 against Hugo Chavez was an enormous danger, and only by the mobilization, the spontaneous coming into the street of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who defended Hugo Chavez, who forced his return back to the presidency, that was the only thing that kept a fascist coup and fascist rule from taking place. The plotters at that time in 2002 had actually canceled the Constitution, they abolished the Congress, and they already had a list of people that they were going to round up who were part of the government or supportive of the revolution. Those plans of overthrow of the Bolivarian Revolution have not ended. They've taken on different forms, whether trying to run opposition members in the parliament and refusing to recognize the victory of the majority of the Socialist Party members, or they include the violence that took place in 2012 and really have not ended. They include the U.S. media from the New York Times on engaging in a very intense coverage right now of myths and lies, trying to isolate President Maduro, trying to say that the economic chaos, the economic difficulties that the country is going through are the result of the Bolivarian Revolution, of a policy in which in the last 15 years, hundreds of thousands of houses have been built for the poor. Healthcare is now available to anybody who needs it for free, thanks to tens of thousands of Cuban doctors in Venezuela. A literacy campaign, a very successful literacy campaign, was carried out in the early years of the revolution. All these social gains and progress in the country are the result of a government that has taken control of the oil on behalf of the people, and this goes completely counter to the U.S. aims in all of Latin America to turn back the clock when they used to have domination and control of all the economies of Latin America in the 1960s and 70s when the U.S. and the CIA installed and backed up fascist dictatorships from Argentina to Chile and to Venezuela and other countries as well. The U.S. is intent on keeping the progress in Latin America from continuing, and this includes the alliance of Cuba, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and some Caribbean countries which are allied in the ALBA alliance, the Bolivarian Alternative for the Americas. This is a complete turn away from what it used to be in the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, when the U.S. dictated to Latin America. Now we see in Latin America whole institutes of the Latin American states without the United States, without Canada's influence. We see the U.S. becoming so isolated in Latin America that this coming April, when the Organization of American States, the OAS, is holding its Summit of the Americas, which is dominated by the U.S., the U.S. finally had to accede to Latin American countries that Cuba must be included. Cuba had been expelled from the OAS in 1962, and this is the first year that Cuba will be allowed to participate because of the U.S. isolation in Latin America. But at the same time that the U.S. Declared in mid-December that they would engage in negotiations with Cuba to have normalized relations, that very same month they installed and imposed sanctions, punishing sanctions against the Venezuelan government. And right now, in February, the government is imposing even more sanctions against the seizing of assets in Venezuela that are in the United States, and more punishment against leaders of the government.
Right. And we just have a minute here, but at this pivotal stage, you know, what is the role of revolutionaries here in the U.S. in the belly of the beast?
The struggle in Venezuela has received very, very little notice in the United States because the U.S. media has chosen to ignore the progress. But now that the U.S. and the right wing in Venezuela are on a special offensive to try to overthrow the government, especially now they're more aggressive, they are starting to use the media to attack the Bolivarian Revolution. This is where the movement in the United States comes in. On March 5th, there will be rallies, forums, and solidarity actions for Venezuela from New York to Washington, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Tucson, Sacramento, and the number is growing of the cities, including Chicago. We need to show in the streets and in the public that there is a danger of another coup against Venezuela. It's an ongoing threat, and that we demand U.S. hands off Venezuela. Let the people of Venezuela determine their own destiny, free of interference from Washington.
Thanks so much, Gloria.
Thank you.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more for the struggle for justice.
Listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets, at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events, and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.